Hello, everyone. Welcome to Research VR. We are joined by Chris.
Hello.
Peter.
Hi there.
And I, Azad. Hello.
Hello, everyone.
For this week, we actually want to try out a kind of a different formatting of the show. And so this today we're going to be covering one major kind of research topic that is a really big problem in VR, and it's the health problems and the motion sickness. So in between every episode, we might even include an interview episode where we have someone from the industry, some kind of a developer that helps us understand how they've actually been implementing these research findings into their own apps and experiences. So one episode will really go in depth in the research and the papers and help break them down for you. And in another episode, we'll talk about how that's been implemented. So let us know what you think. We love your feedback. We love any kind of information and criticism, comments, concerns that you can provide, because it just helps us get better and we can provide better content for anyone that's interested. So
we got, in fact, a lot of feedback, and we are definitely working on the stuff you suggested, like sound quality and the way we speak, how we choose topics and how long it should be. And we would really appreciate if you would be, tweeting around our show, showing it with your friends, because the more listeners we have, the more motivated we are.
We're happy that we've actually been gaining a certain following already. And it just shows that how much of an interest there is in VR and how much people are trying to learn how to do it better. And that's all we're trying to do, is really trying to break down the decades of research that have been done in this topic, and combining cognitive science and into how virtual reality should actually be made and developed for the person and for a human person to actually use. I'm glad you guys are enjoying it, and rate, like, subscribe, and whatnot. We have a Twitter called Research VR Cast, and you can find more information. We usually tweet out cool researches and things that we find that would be really relevant to what we are talking about. And that's what do you guys think that for housekeeping? Anything else to add before we start with the research side of the podcast?
In the research podcast, if you at any time feel lost or just overwhelmed by amount of information that we are presenting you, don't hesitate to look at the notes. Everything will be there.
Exactly. We are very detailed with our show notes, with citations, with the papers, with links, with videos. Look in the show notes, look in the chapter marks. And for this episode, actually, we'll be linking the entire notes that we wrote, because this is going to be a bit more structured of a show than usually. It's not as much of a discussion and more of us. It's almost like an audio lecture three people are giving together. Topic.
By the way, a few of our listeners were quite surprised that we have chapter marks. iTunes usually don't show it, but some players can. And when we do the show notes for the show, we usually have also the chapter marks that divide the topic-wise structure. So you can, skip stuff that you already know, or just go forward, or go specifically to the parts that you're interested in.
Right. The iTunes, actually the podcast app on an iPhone, does support the chapter marks really well.
Nice.
So they do it really well. Unfortunately, what I use, the client called Downcast, I don't think they support it as well. But they do have, if you have the time stamp in the show notes, then you could skip to it there. So anyway, so let us know how we're doing, what we can do better, and let's get on with the show.
Okie dokie. So let's look at the bigger picture first. We have many different adverse health problems that virtual reality may cause, or that may happen during virtual reality experience. First and biggest of them is motion sickness, which we will talk in detail today. Then we also have eye strain, fatigue, like, for example, gorilla arm, which we will talk in detail more on another podcast, but it's basically an idea that you hold your arm for too long in front of your face, for example, like with leap motion. Then there are sometimes physical injuries, like straining your muscles from the repeated movement, and hygiene. That is usually a big topic when you go to Expo and show your VR to like 100 or 1,000 people.
Exactly.
Which will be covered also at some point soon.
Yeah. That hygiene, that last one actually is interesting because if you've ever been to any kind of a meetup or expo, yeah, if you're the 30th person in line and you put it on, you will feel this disgusting sweat that the foam has just completely soaked in, and you put it on your face. You're like, ugh.
Don't forget to clean your controllers from time to time too.
Absolutely.
Just like in fitness club.
Mm-hmm. That's a good comparison to make.
Yeah.
Cool, Christoph. So let's start talking about motion sickness and what are the real, what's the symptoms that you can know that they're getting motion sick from?
Okay, so there was number of studies done in 90s and 2000s where people were trying to categorize and measure motion sickness. And from those measurements, from one of the studies by Kennedy et al. From 93, that was done on more than 2,000 soldiers. We know mm-hmm. that there is three categories of symptoms for motion sickness. We have oculomotor, disorientation, and nausea symptoms.
Nausea, yeah.
Yeah. So oculomotor would be eye strain, difficulty to focus, blurred vision, and headaches. Then disorientation is the most common, where we have dizziness and vertigo. And then we have that last one, the nausea. Yes.
Yeah.
That is stomach awareness, increased salivation, and burping.
That's right.
In most of the cases, just reaction to stomach awareness.
So these are physical symptoms that you feel due to virtual reality or any kind of a badly designed virtual reality experience. Yes.
The most experienced ones are eye strain and stomach awareness. And stomach awareness is the one that stays for the longest, at mm-hmm. least for me and most of the people I talk to.
And by stomach awareness, you mean just like you start feeling being aware of your stomach and you feel like something's happening in yes. your stomach. Yeah. And it sometimes can be really bad. I haven't thrown up, but like you definitely feel it.
Then there is, as usual, a bit of a confusion when it comes to definitions. So when we think about motion sickness, this is a very general term that is not limited only to virtual reality, but it's all kinds of traveling sickness and alike. Like when you go with the car and at some point you feel sick, that's also motion sickness.
Mm-hmm.
Then we also have cyber sickness that is used only and solely for the health problems caused by playing virtual reality.
That's right.
While it is about visually induced motion sickness, in computer-generated virtual worlds, for some reason, people decided that it is only about virtual reality. Because I know people that get motion sick from playing just games on 2D screen, but this is not cyber sickness. Cyber sickness is used only for virtual reality.
So even if it's just a FPS shooter on a TV screen and you feel motion sickness from that, would you define that as cyber sickness as well?
Nope.
Wouldn't
this
you?
Is,
you wouldn't.
This is not cyber sickness. Cyber sickness is only when you put head-mounted display on and then...
I feel like that's actually just like one researcher's definition of it.
No, this is actually pretty much most, if not all, papers that deal with virtual reality.
Okay.
I mean, once again, we are here on quite thin ground in terms of definitions. We could always define things differently. As some people books are also a sort of virtual reality or movies. So we have to get at some point, to some definitions, but you obviously could debate them.
I have to say this for our listeners, like research is very much based on, so in the beginning of your paper, you really kind of laid out the groundwork of your definitions. And sometimes you come up with your own, or sometimes you use the industry standard. But like, research is so very focused on like getting the right definition for something, which is what we're trying to help you like understand, like put it out there. But in the end, it doesn't really matter as much what you call it, rather than understanding what it is and what you do with it. So this is just that we're laying out the groundwork for what motion sickness, you know, how it differentiates from everything else in cyber sickness. So
yeah, we could spend another whole podcast on discussing how important definition is, because from my perspective, this is pretty important to have the same definition between people, so we understand each other. But this is totally another podcast.
That's right. For scientific purposes, that's true. You know, for having two papers correlate together, you know, like for everything to be kind of lined up and matching up, you want to have the same definitions. But anyway, that's very research.
And then we also have a third type of motion sickness, that is simulator sickness, that comes from the technology that you're using itself. So if you have those flight simulators, you would get sick from the simulator itself, not from the factors or like the real flying. And then
definitely
Jason Gerald in his VR book actually proposes that instead of saying motion sickness or cyber sickness or simulator sickness, we actually call it altogether VR sickness.
Yeah. Yeah. That's just, that makes sense to me.
Yes. Now,
cool.
Moving forward,
let's talk about why. Let's go into the why this happens and why we even feel like we're gonna throw up.
I've came across during my research on this topic across five different theories. First one, and the most promising one, is sensory conflict, which in most of the cases happens when your eyes and vestibular system say something different. By vestibular system, I mean this piece of your ear that makes you keep balance or understand that you're in balance. So if you rotate in virtual reality, the picture rotates around you, but you don't rotate, then you have this conflict between your what your eyes are telling you and between what your ears are telling you.
That's right. And if we can quickly add, that's you usually feel that whenever someone takes away the motion control from you in VR and they start controlling you, that's probably the easiest way of causing motion sickness.
Yes.
That's why roller coasters and all of that is problematic. It's because you yourself don't have control.
There is even an easier one where you just freeze the picture.
Right.
Have you ever came across that experience when the game just froze and then you were still in the movement because it was a very active game? Mm-hmm. I have to take head mode display instantly when it happens.
Yeah.
Because otherwise I'm doomed and this is end of gaming for the moment.
Right. Or I actually try to keep my head still and look at the same place where that picture was and pretend that it's still moving. Or just close your eyes. That's another one.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But yeah, stuck pictures in VR are horrible, like stuck frames.
Hmm. That's why also so latency is important, but we'll come back to that.
We'll get to that. So that was the first theory, sensory conflict. The second theory is
my personal favorite, not for the research reason, but for how it sounds, because it's a poison theory, or more professionally, evolutionary theory. So this theory says that you want to basically vomit just because your organism says you're poisoned. Because if you start feeling dizzy, this is most likely because you ate some plant that actually was poisonous.
That's right.
Or that you ate too old meat or something.
And your body's first reaction when it starts feeling that your vestibular system and your proprioceptive system, like they're not correlating together, is like, okay, I'm poisoned. What is going to be the first thing I'm going to do? I'm just going to throw up so that if I ate something poisoned, it's going to be out of me, which evolutionarily completely makes sense. So that it's a pretty solid theory in our opinion.
As a theory, yes. However, there is not much data supporting that. Also, right. This particular theory is not really giving us predictory power, like saying how severe motion sickness is going to be for an individual. Mm-hmm. So while it sounds it's not that useful.
Right. At least it explains the why instead of how.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Another one is postural instability theory. This one says that you simply need to learn how to deal with this particular system. So when we start walking as children, we might feel also a bit motion sick at that point because we still don't know how to walk and how the physics work and how this particular world works.
Yeah.
And this one gives us a certain hope. Basically, if this theory has any merit to it, that means that we can overcome motion sickness just by doing it more often, just by playing virtual reality. So you simply have certain habituation effect over time.
And you think I think there is some merit to this, right? Like, have you seen people improving their motion sickness by just experience?
Well, I know that I improved my motion sickness.
Exactly. I mean, even with a sample size of one or two, I can attest to this.
Actually,
as well.
There is a study and a big theory that I will come mm-hmm. to later as a trick for dealing with motion sickness.
Okay.
So stay tuned. It's coming.
Cool.
The next one.
So that was yeah.
Sorry. Do you have?
No, please. Okay.
The next one is rest frame hypothesis. This one says that in a real world, we always have a certain reference point or reference region that is stable, static compared to everything else, like horizon line or buildings afar. And in virtual reality, that could be also background, or that could be visualization of your nose or a cockpit, mm-hmm. which we will come in detail later. So this one is particularly practical because it gives us the actual implementations.
That's right.
And then the last one is eye movement theory. And this one says that the motion sickness appears due to unnatural eye movement, which is based on technology limits that we have right now. So the latency and similar things.
Mm-hmm. So all of these theories definitely have their own angle as to how they explain motion sickness and how, and they, but it's good that we have different theories because they all suggest different solutions. And for the most part that we're going to be, you know, talking about the solutions in a second, but they all kind of work in their own way. And so probably the best thing to do is to create a combination of these. Don't you agree?
Actually, Jason Gerald in his VR book proposes a certain model for that, which I didn't want to spend time here on explaining because it's pretty complex and one has to read into that by himself.
Sure. Okay. Well, we can discuss it later on when we're talking about it.
When we come back to the adverse problems and we have a summary of the big topic, we could speak again about the general model or maybe make our own here on the podcast.
Definitely. I mean, that's what we're here for.
Yeah. Then we have a topic of measuring motion sickness, which is particularly practical when you're like a AAA studio that just wants a AAA experience to be released and you have a certain money for user experience tests. They're like full-blown app tests, not just on expos showing, but you can actually invite people and pay them as subjects, just like in the normal research.
Right, and getting good quantifiable data, essentially.
So first of all, let's see about challenges. There is a large variance between individuals, so it's hard to make a general statement here. Then some users adapt to cyber sickness. So you would also have to account how much experience they have with virtual reality. And those two lead to the fact that you need a huge sample size, which means you need a lot of people to be tested.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the methods? First one, as I mentioned before at the beginning, in 92 and 93, Kennedy et al. Developed the Kennedy Simulator Sickness Questionnaire. that was based on 16 US Navy flight simulators and had in total more than 2,000 users there with more than one session. In the end, it gave us the overview of the symptoms, and it's a very nice method and doesn't take so much. Important thing, you have to do it after the experience, because if you do it before, people feel more sick just because they are prone to do so. They are primed by the questioner.
Exactly. If you prime them and ask them like, hey, you know, you might feel motion sick, they might actually feel more motion sick than they usually would.
And it's not just a theory, because this particular thing was tested. They did actually number of studies. This questionnaire is used for a long time. And some people didn't believe that, because if you have before and after, you have a nice score in the end. You have a change, measure of change. But in the end, you have to do it only at the end.
So I have a question about that, because currently I'm in my lab, we're running studies in basically using a DK2, and we have to do a pre-screen before. And in the pre-screen, we ask them about if they feel motion sickness on a regular basis, or you know, to a severe basis, or do they also feel severe claustrophobia. So by priming them with these questions, how much of the data, I mean, how else would you go about doing that? Because we don't want, you know, someone to have a bad experience per se, but like,
I'd say those, you see what I mean? Those questions that you just proposed right now are long-term. You know, you're not asking about your current state, but you're asking about last months, last years.
I see.
So in theory, you can ask them by email before, like 2 days or a day before the study. So not directly before, but a little longer. Or you can do it afterwards as a part of the bigger questionnaire.
Okay. That's actually a great point, because our system is kind of like that. They have a pre-screen before coming to the lab itself. And so that's where they can ask them to answer the question. And we can hope that they don't, you know, really concentrate on that question or that feeling itself of like, oh, am I going to feel motion sick if I do this?
Yeah, I would either do it a long time before, so like more than a day, or after the experiment. Maybe even not even directly after the session, because they might be primed by experiment.
Okay. And so what was he came up with a questionnaire, didn't he?
Yes.
Kennedy.
So he has not so long questionnaire that in the end gives us 12 or so symptoms. So initially he found 19 different symptoms that everybody reported. He squeezed it to 16, but now we can speak about 12 or so.
Okay.
And there is a whole system there where you have a 4-point scale and 4 scores in the end. So it's a nice questionnaire. And it's a very standardized one. So you can trust it.
Right.
And then we have behavioral measurement that could be used on expos. So it's a postural stability test. In other words, it's that test when the policeman stops you and wants to check if you're drunk or not. So he makes you walk a straight line. But to make it professionally, you have to cross your hands in front of you on your chest and then walk a straight line feet by feet when the heel of your front feet touches the toes on the back feet. And then you count the number of times that a person loses his stability. You can do it even more professionally by applying body tracking, maybe even some high accuracy body tracking, but it's doable with Kinect. I've been working with the guy from University of Michigan from kinesiology lab that was actually comparing Kinect with Vicon system, and Kinect was totally sufficient for postural tests and measurements.
So what can you say more about the posture that you're taking? I mean, are certain postures more prone to feeling motion sickness than others? Like sitting rather than standing? Is there a difference there?
Yes. So seated experience is much better, much less motion sickness risk bringing. However, the standing experience brings to the table the fact that your vestibular system might not be, might be tricked again.
What do you mean by that? So, tricked how? In a sense, like, are you falling when you're, if you're falling?
Imagine that you have HTC Vive experience that is standing, and there you might be walking forward, but the HTC cameras have only this limited region where they track it, so you cannot walk all the time. Therefore, you will have some system in which, for example, you're walking with the gamepad. So your vestibular system gets information about rotation, but doesn't get information about the fact that you're walking forward.
But wouldn't you argue that having at least one system accounted for, you know, correlating with what your movements are, will reduce motion sickness? So the fact that you are standing and like looking, you know, rotating left and right, but maybe you're not walking, that's better than if you're sitting and not really moving and rotating and walking. Do you see what I'm saying?
Throwing into the mix here presence, I'd say you need to adjust your experience, maybe not for the reason of motion sickness, but for the reason of presence. So if you have a seated experience, you sit in virtual reality. You have a walking experience, you walk in virtual reality. You have a standing experience, you stand in virtual reality.
Yes, that's definitely, you have, if the avatar is not correlating with what you're doing in real life, then presence is very much broken.
However, seated experience is easier for your vestibular system because you then just rotate. And then your body doesn't move to the sides or forward or backwards because you just rotate.
The, definitely having like an office chair, like a swivel chair, I've noticed, even for Google Cardboard, is so important. Because you do have this 360 around you. So moving on. Do you want to talk about the factors contributing to motion sickness, as in the real?
Yes.
Go ahead.
We have two types of those factors. One come from the technology limitations that we have at the moment. And another one comes from individual differences. So let's speak about the system factors. First of all, first and foremost, we have to have latency below 30 milliseconds. There is no discussion here. It has to be less. Otherwise, you have this conflict between your eyes and your vestibular system.
Definitely.
It's
I'm looking at the latency's numbers, and the DK2 itself is actually 20 milliseconds. And the CV1, I believe, is like lower than that as well. It might be 20 milliseconds.
Well, the fact is, you cannot just look at the numbers and you know, be sure that they are true or not. Especially if you think about the fact that the first and second Oculus had a quite shitty screen, right? And then if your computer does not provide the sufficient frame rate, and you know, there is something happening in the game that suddenly the frame rate drops, it can be significantly higher.
Exactly. So, I mean, the system itself is capable, or at least the Oculus and the HTC are capable, but you need to make sure your experience can actually run at sub 30 milliseconds latency.
There is like an established term called photon to motion, or motion to photon.
That's right.
So that has to be, you know, below 20 in an ideal case.
So actually, can we talk about motion to photon and how it relates to latency? Is that, I mean, is that exactly the same thing, or is motion to photon including latency and other things as well?
Yeah, well, let's say if you move your head to the left, you want the picture to be moving with your head.
I mean, how do you measure? Motion to photon?
There are some kind of devices that people have built. I think they're benchmarking the VR goggles with it. However, I think the best thing is just basically put it on and see if you see a lag if you move your head extensively left and right.
Right, right. I was just trying to see if there's already an industry standard in, as to you know, measuring.
Yes, we will later link it in the show notes. Future mark.
There is a future mark and base mark.
So there are two devices. Yeah.
Okay.
We can have actually a devoted show just to this topic.
Exactly.
This is a very interesting one, and we can summarize it as latency is important below 30 milliseconds, but technically we can spend easily 2 hours talking about the details here. Continuing.
Okay, yeah, no, I completely agree.
Then continuing on the system factors influence causing motion sickness. Then we have calibration, which means how much your trackers are off. So if you ever used camera for position tracking, for head tracking, for Oculus DK2, you know that the moment it loses the range, then it goes crazy. But sometimes you also have this offset when your head moves, but the experience actually doesn't move as precisely as your head. And this may also cause the motion sickness for the same conflict reason as latency. Then we have tracking accuracy. So how much jitter there is going to be in your data. So if you have Kinect and you move your hands, then sometimes they may jump or they may not move as accurately as you want them to.
As in, so millimeter, so let's say 1-to-1 ratio between your rotation movement of not just your head, but also your body as well.
It's yes and no. So the accuracy would be how many degrees do you need to move so that the system registers it?
Oh, I see what you mean. So, yes. Right. The hardware limitations. Yes.
So if you have HTC Vive controller, you have 1 centimeter accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
So
1 millimeter.
No, 1 centimeter.
So that 1 centimeter. Yes. Okay. So that's actually quite big.
It's totally sufficient. If you had a chance to test it, it's impressive. Absolutely impressive. Mm-hmm. Then we have tracking precision.
I mean, this is the whole, you know, accuracy versus precision. Yeah. Precision. You learn about this if you take like a chem class, and they talk about scales and whatnot, and what is accuracy and what is precision. Mm-hmm. Basically, easiest way to summarize precision is that if you're doing the same thing over and over again, are you getting the results to be very similar to each other? Like if you're testing the same exact thing, is your device precise enough that it's doing the same exact thing, even if it's not accurate? Like even if it's not where it should be, but is it precise though? Are the data points close to each other?
Yes.
I think that's pretty much the only like difference we can talk about.
Then we have lack of position tracking. So just like with Gear VR, where you have only rotation of your head, but you don't have head tracking.
Mm-hmm.
This may be a source of motion sickness in some experiences. So if you design an experience, you need to pay attention if you have head tracking or body tracking or not.
Can you talk about the different experiences that you can create by... So obviously the Gear VR doesn't have positional tracking and Oculus does. And so how would you kind of modify your system so that it, you know, you either have positional tracking or you don't, and so you don't cause motion sickness? Like how would you design around that constraint?
I'd say it's about the goal in your game. So a blunt example would be you have those concepts for Oculus where you have a fighting game and you can dodge by moving your head position, which you clearly can do if you don't have head tracking. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I was gonna say, I mean, how are you doing that in a Gear VR because you don't have that positional tracking? So if you want to duck down, it doesn't really register that.
You can slide down. So
you can slide down.
So the difference would be that when you have head tracking, you can have a continuous reaction, while if you have Gear VR, where you have a button input, then you have this hard-coded distance that you will move by. You know, this hard-coded reaction. So you can still duck down when you slide down the touchpad, but it will be by this pre-designed distance.
There is actually also a third possibility that you use the acceleration sensor of the Gear VR. Let's say it's not very precise enough to do the now real life tracking, but if you like really fast lean forward or really fast go low, you can extract that information from the accelerometer and make the person duck.
So basically we have gesture as an input.
Gestures,
yes,
okay.
In a certain way, yes.
And I think this is going to be, let's talk about this now, that the lack of positional tracking will definitely go away within the next couple of months. As far as we know, actually, even the next Gear VR will have some kind of inside out with positional tracking at least.
There are rumors,
because
yes.
There are rumors, but like the health effects of not having positional tracking and the immersion factor and the presence factor, they're also limited by not having it, that I think every system that will be coming out soon will have at least some form of positional tracking. But for now, if you're designing, you know, whatever, an app, an experience, you still do need to consider this constraint.
We will always have to consider that, because we will always have Google Cardboard or another similar product that is very simplified. And the idea of the Google Cardboard is that it's minimalistic.
Mm-hmm. But even then, I think within a year, maybe Cardboard will be, you know, you'll definitely, I don't know how you would go around doing it, maybe some kind of clever math to figure out the accelerator and how it's moving and where it's moving. But anyway, you just basically know that at least for now, you really have to account for lack of positional tracking, at least for the Gear.
Yes.
Cool.
Another very interesting source of motion sickness is field of view. So what we are speaking right now in technology of virtual reality is the more the better. But this is actually not true, because for at least for user experience here, because some users have a very sensitive periphery of their vision, in the way that if you give them more periphery vision, like more degrees of view, they may be more prone to motion sickness.
So this is kind of an individualistic difference that we've been seeing.
Yes.
Interesting. We don't really know why, do we? It's more of just
there are indications that there is more picture that moves in front of your eyes. So there is more data to be calculated. So then if you have more data for your eyes to calculate, like more signal, then it's going to also be more precise.
And some people might have more sensitive photoreceptors on the edge of their periphery than, or at least motion kind of detection.
And then another point here is that if you have more details in the scene, like more dynamic objects, then it's going to also cause motion sickness for some people.
You know, now that I think about it, it makes total sense, because the fovea, which is the 10 degrees right in the middle of your vision, that is where you can, you know, that you have the most rods. You have the most cones, so you see the most color and the most highest resolution. But in the periphery of your vision, which is around the edges, you have a lot more rods that see black and white and less colors. But you're actually very, very good at seeing motion at the edges of your eyes. So it would make total sense that if you have a small field of view, like right around your fovea or a little bit bigger than that, you wouldn't really feel as motion sick as you would if it's entirely around you.
Well, it's a Gaussian distribution, you know. It's not like the more the better, linearly, but you can't have too little, but you can't have too much.
Do you think with systems like, let's say, Star VR, or what other HMDs are there that have like over 100 degrees
it's
of field of view?
The one that the Void is using. Raptor, something like that.
That's their own one.
Yeah.
I know Star VR has another one where they actually just place the screens at a, I think that's like 30, 40 degree angle from each other, or maybe even more than that. And it just gives you a huge sense of like field of view. I wonder how they're dealing with motion sickness, actually.
I had never chance to test it. And there is not much word about them. They don't have too much content for their head mounted display. So it's hard to say right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
But from theoretical standpoint of view, it may be tricky.
Hmm. I saw them at VR LA, and they were showing off the Walking Dead demo. I didn't get a chance to do it, but it seems like at least maybe they're getting like partner deals with content creators and getting them on, but they don't have like an obvious following like Oculus or HTC.
It's hard to jump the train at this point for like the major head-mounted display for PCs.
And I mean, if you're going to develop something, you want it to be device ambiguous. Like, you want as many users as you can, because there are barely any users currently that have the system or will be getting it. True. Anyway, but that we're diverging.
Coming back to the topic, another thing that we need to think about during the design is judder. So a jerky or unsmooth visual motion. So when you move very fast, or when the positional tracking camera for DK2 is losing the range, then you have this jumping of the picture that is not smooth movement, but it's just switching the reference. And then we also have refresh rate that has to be above 60 hertz. That is for the reasons, technical reasons of latency. If you have higher refresh rate, then you have less judder, just because the picture is going to change faster, and then we don't have a flicker. Flicker is also another technical problem, and it's another adverse health problem, because it may cause epilepsy attack, just because some people are very prone to this flickering.
Flicker, can you explain this? Because
flickering is how many times the picture changes on the screen.
Isn't that also a refresh?
Let's say when something flashes with certain colors. So when you would buy games 10, 20 years ago, there would usually be some kind of warnings that you can get an epilepsy seizure from it, because there would be many colors flashing. So there are certain patterns and certain things that can trigger you be feeling really bad. And obviously with the frame rate drop and the screen not supporting enough refresh rate, just the probability that something triggers something unpleasant in you higher.
Yes. And 60 hertz is this refresh rate where most of the people don't see the flickering anymore. Because for if you want to do an experiment, you can switch your screen to the 30 hertz refresh rate. And then you will see what flicker means.
Yes. In fact, people, in theory at least, if you measure it, can pick up like 30 different pictures per second. However, we can definitely pick up flickering, that there is flickering. Maybe not the different pictures, but there is something not right between them. And if you think about how game engines render the picture, I mean, you move your head, the next picture is rendered on the GPU, it has to be sent to the monitor, and there is some delay between it. It's not that, you know, after you move your head, some magic happens, and instantly the next picture comes to the screen, and then the screen has just, you know, to have a proper refresh rate. There might be some buffering in between, like triple buffering. Some supporters say you should turn it off, or basically for VR, the GPU buffers the pictures. Also, one of the problems is that the GPU sometimes calculates faster, sometimes less faster, depending on how much explosion there is or light particles, right? So there might be delays. And then you want your screen to be, you know, able to instantly flip when the picture comes. So the screen is not the bottleneck.
So what is important here, when you already reached 60 hertz, what is more important is consistency of the refresh rate, not going higher and higher. So if you switch between 70, 60, 50, 40, and 80, then it's going to cause problems more than if you just stay at 60 hertz.
Right.
Also, one thing that Oculus invented is low
persistence.
Exactly, where they basically turn off the screen in between the frames, so you don't have such strong blur effect. And the new metrics of the screens that they're using in the Oculus, it will be the final version, can actually turn all the pixels at once. So for you who might not know it, a screen usually builds pixel by pixel. So if you have a very fast camera, you could track it, how all the pixels light after each other. However, they used a panel with a matrix that can actually light up all the pixels simultaneously, which is quite rare.
I have a question before we move on. Do you guys have heard about the asynchronous, what's it called? The Lucky Palmer came out and said that they're doing asynchronous time warp, I think.
Yes.
Can you explain that? Yeah. Is that relevant to what we're talking about?
It is quite relevant.
I'd say we have a special podcast on that, because this is a method to deal with the display time response and persistence of picture and latency.
Yeah, maybe to summarize it short, you can do different tricks. For example, you could predict where the head will be moving. So, I mean, if your head is anyhow, you know, rotating from left to right, you can kind of predict and pre-render the the frame already faster. This is one of the things that the time warp does, as far as I understand it.
Cool. No, that's very cool. And we definitely will come back to the, you know, we could talk about optics and hardware in a later show.
And I think also, if you have your Gear VR and you put it on and you take some games that is, you know, very heavy on your calculation processor of the phone, and you rotate your head very fast, you will notice that there are two things happening. First of all, the picture is not rendered in time. However, if you move your head, there is still movement, and that is also part of this asynchronous rendering, where if you move your head to the left, but the frame did not render in time, you just see black screen there where the picture has not been rendered. However, you still have motion, which prevents you from feeling sick. So even if
You explain that?
Okay.
Sorry, I missed that, yeah.
Let's say you rotate your head to the left very fast, and the GPU of the Gear VR is not being able to handle the frames so fast. What will be happening is that instead of a freezed or frozen frame in front of you, the frame will be there where it's supposed to be, and your head movement is simulated by the fact that there will be some black area left or right. Like when you move to the left, there will be a black area left, and then the next frame will basically load.
Right.
Does it make sense?
You can see this effect when you play the Gear VR game and when it's loading, and then you move around. So in the moment that it's loading, it sometimes like freezes for a moment. And then you see exactly that effect, that like half of the picture is cut off because the frame is rendered somewhere else.
To discuss it a little bit more technical, what's happening is that the head rotation is a separate process that yields this rotation and also the rendering of this black stuff around it. And then there is basically the real proper rendered VR environment overlaying it. And when it's not there, you still have this movement.
Right. At least, so basically, what we can take away from that is never lose head rotation, or at least, that's the worst, one of the worst things you can do in VR. And there's clever tricks to kind of getting around that, even if your GPU can't handle the load of rendering a certain frame quickly enough.
Okay, so we can move on to individual factors. Now we've talked about system factors that in time can be no longer a problem when we have a better technology, but individual factors will be there. So the first one is lateral movement. Imagine that you're playing an FPS game and you press A button. You go just directly to the left. Not forward, not back, but directly to the left. This, for some people, is actually a problem. This may cause motion sickness.
And it actually causes like the kind of the worst form of motion sickness versus the other ones. At least that's what I've heard from developers and whatnot. It's that really don't try to do lateral movements at all. Like that's probably the easiest way you can get someone to be motion sick.
But it's not for all people.
Not for all.
Yeah. Then
at least it's common enough.
Second point is experience with virtual reality. So as we said before, according to this theory of postural instability, if you get trained enough, then you deal with motion sickness better. And it's actually supported by the fact that developers are getting better and their proneness to motion sickness is smaller. Then, as we talked before, if you tell someone that he's going to feel motion sick or that he can feel motion sick, then he will feel motion sick in some cases.
Just so that's priming.
Exactly. Just like giving this questionnaire about motion sickness before the experiment. Then the statistics show that females are 3 times more susceptible to motion sickness than males, for whatever reason.
So I have some comments about that, and we often in VR research see some gender differences. Like in whatever experiment you do, you'll see it happen. Actually, like one of the good explanations we've kind of been using is that it really comes down to experience, and it's not just VR experience, but actually having gaming experience and the ability to move around in a 3D environment. I mean, virtually. I mean, either in a game, on a, you know, WASD, thumbstick, whatever. It's slowly that gender gap is becoming smaller and smaller, because like my professor that was doing VR research in the 90s, he had a huge gender difference. But like back then, it's like, think of who was actually playing video games and had experience. Sure. So it might come down to somewhat of an experience. I don't know if you could fully explain the gender differences because of that.
It would be interesting experiment to run some statistics. Yeah.
I agree. It's a hard thing to quantify. You know, what are you going to ask them? Like, how many years of gaming have you done?
There are questionnaires for gamers' experience. Yeah. So the questions would be, how many times per week do you play? How many hours do you play? Which games do you play? Mm-hmm. There are actually other experiments in which this particular factor is important, and you need to take it under consideration. So there should be some standardized questionnaires already.
Agreed.
And then you have this SSQ, so the short simulators, stress. No, not this one, simulator sickness questionnaire, which you can just give and measure, actually, the subjective motion sickness afterwards. So you can correlate, so you can have a professional study to measure that. Anyhow, another point is expectations versus mental model, which means that it is important what do you expect from the experience and what is your mental model from the real life.
That's right. So that's a big factor right now if you're doing any kind of UX. Experimenting, designing, whatever, you really have to understand what the person's mental model is. And what a mental model can really be defined at is that, what does the user think the system is, or how can you interact with it? How is it going to respond? And sometimes it's called theory of mind, as like, can you really go into someone else's head? You know, can you think of what the other person will be thinking about when they look at this? And the best way you can really do that is just by testing. So by doing things like, it's called speaking out loud. Basically, you give the user whatever system you're developing and you tell them to kind of read or do whatever they're doing, but also speak out loud about what they think is happening, or, you know, just basically completely talking throughout the entire experience. Yes. That way you can really understand their mental model as to like, do they understand how the system is working? Is it, you know, you never ever want to hear the term, oh, what is it doing now? Like, that's kind of shows that your indication of the status of the system is quite bad, and you need to have more loading symbols, or I mean, that's not the best way to
I've
do it. But
I heard actually a story about that method. So there was a game in which you have objects floating around you. So you can choose those objects. So it's like the objects go a bit on the abstract level, and they appear around you, so you can choose from them. And in the first version, they were just static, because the designers thought, okay, if they start to move, it's going to cause motion sickness because of dynamics and refresh rate and all that stuff. And then subjects, every time that they saw those objects flying out, they said, it's broken. It just froze. And then they changed, they added a small jitter that they shook a little. And it was solving completely the problem.
Maybe it
was more in the context of presence more than motion sickness here, but I guess we can come up with the examples for the motion sickness and expectations too.
Right. Cool. So
Yes.
So that was number five. So next one is...
How to put HMD correctly. It's a big topic for Google Cardboard, because it's enough if you move your phone to the side by 1 millimeter and then, so to say, calibration goes off. I mean, the vergence doesn't work anymore because the middle of the screen has been pushed a little too much to the left eye or to the right eye, and then it's gone. And so people usually are not experienced with that stuff. So they see it wrong, but they say, it's okay, it's fine. I think that's how it's supposed to work. And then they just strain themselves.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's one of the biggest problems with Google Cardboard is the lateral movement of the phone within the cardboard itself. Mm-hmm. And good solutions that I've seen for that is by using basically it's called Omido VR, yep. Omido Mini, I think. And it's basically a clip-on. It looks like small little reading glasses that clips onto the screen itself instead of putting your screen in a cardboard. And it goes right in the middle of the two images. And it's hard for if as long as you have a case on your phone, it actually doesn't really shift around much at all. That's the best way I've kind of been dealing with demoing Google Cardboard to people instead of putting it in real cardboard, because I did notice that nose bridge kind of moving around a little bit.
On the other hand, then you have the sides of the phone exposed because you have just those glasses that pop out.
Except if you have an iPhone 6 Plus or 6S Plus, definitely you get the vision covered.
Always better for iPhones. That I have.
Exactly. Well, I mean, if you have, you know, a Note, Samsung Note, you know, in your Gear VR instead of just an S6, you do get a wider field of view as well.
True.
Perhaps with a lesser density.
Well, it also depends on which S6 you have. There is this S6 Edge Plus, which is, I think, even bigger than the Note.
What?
But
really?
You can't put it in Gear VR.
Yes, you can.
With the new one?
Yes.
Hmm.
I don't think it's this S6 Edge Plus. I think it's like S6 Plus,
no,
right?
No, it's S6 Edge Plus.
So it's the Edge, but bigger.
Yes, it's a very strange name.
So many names. Yes. So many little iterations of the same phone. Yes. It's really hard to keep
It's not even
track.
The same phone. It's a little bit different.
Mm.
But, you know.
Cool. But I think the most of the time, in terms of like how people know how to put on the HMD, it's kind of monkey see, monkey do. So I usually put it on in front of them and show how nice. You know how I'm doing it, and how basically I show them like, oh, look at me looking up, looking down, looking around, that you know,
yes.
they can really get a sense of understanding.
But there are also factors that you need to explain them, because you can't see what they see. You can't feel how they have on their head. So if you have
you can't see what they see.
If it's too low or too high, this is also not optimal. So you don't know how it sits on their face. You know, you don't see through their eyes. You don't see through their eyes through the lenses.
You know what? I have a little test for that for our experiment, and I just asked them like, there's basically instructions in the experience itself. So when I put it on them, I'm like, can you read that in front of you? And if you can, read it out loud. And so basically, it's like it's testing if they can focus as well, or they can read it as you know enough. But then I asked them like, can your eyes focus? Like, are you having trouble like converging? And usually, if they can't focus, they can't really read. So that could be one simple method of making sure that a first-time user is actually seeing it focused.
Yes, that's a solution.
Yeah.
Then we have another individual factor, that is sense of balance. So every man and woman perceive their balance a bit differently. And as we talked, balance is kept by vestibular system, and vestibular system is the source of motion sickness, basically. Whatever happens to you, whichever theory you choose, it's vestibular system that is part of this theory. So if your sense of balance is too sensitive, then you will also pick up all those teeny tiny things in virtual reality that are not perfect. Like, seated experience is gonna be the worst for you, because you can't move and you feel that you're supposed to.
How do you measure the sensitivity of someone's balance? Should you account for that? And how should you?
I think that accounting for that is very, very difficult. It can't be measured because you have a vast number of studies of vestibular system, but it's very specialistic and it takes time.
So it's not practical to be able to measure.
I mean, those are individual differences. You can't really measure much of them.
So basically, you have to kind of design for the average user, you know, try to do it for average.
What they do, for example, on Gear VR Shop is that they put information in every single experience. There is like few level scale, good for most of the people, not good for most of the people, and there is like few scales.
Mm-hmm.
So they actually state for how big group this particular experience caused motion sickness or problems.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's basically something for people to keep, you know about it. Maybe we're not that good at measuring it in a practical sense, but everyone has a different sense of balance.
And then the last individual factor, and then we move to tricks and examples how to deal with motion sickness, is the experience of this particular task that you're doing from the real world. So imagine that you have a training app in which you are training to drive a car as a taxi driver through the shortest routes. In the real world, you have a driving wheel, you have pedals, you have all the kinds of stuff around you in the car. But in virtual reality, it's just simplified and it has less accuracy than in the real world. So if you're, again, expectations versus mental model, you know, this training of the tasks is creating a certain expectation towards how you are going to perceive the task in virtual reality.
And I'd say I'd even go further and say that maybe designing your system to match other people's apps and experiences is actually probably a good thing, so that you know you don't have to get acclimated to using your app, right? Kind of how FPSs are now using the same similar, you know, control schemes and whatnot. It's like the trying to match people's mental models from the beginning could go a long way, and it could be definitely a good first time user experience so that people can come back.
Yes
to it.
And no. We are so early into virtual reality medium with the proper technology behind it that we cannot limit ourselves right now. However, I'd say that we should create standards as soon as
possible.
That's
right. That's right. And that's kind of what we're doing. I mean, that's what we're trying to do with this podcast. It's going to help put together a better best practices guide. So let's talk about now examples, like how people have implemented these ideas and how you can copy those ideas. Let's just say, how do you get inspired by other people's projects?
So, for it. First of all, regarding the habituation and this training effect of motion sickness, there were studies showing that the adaptation happens if you have a session, each session between 2 and 5 days apart, so that you can recover and then you push yourself again.
And that makes a lot of sense, because if you know anything about learning and memory, it's called the spacing effect. If you space out the learning or the experience by a certain amount of time, that memory actually retains, and you're better able to recall it later on. So if you space it out a couple of days and do it over and over and over again, then you already will get adapted to it much quicker than if you just have one long session.
Yes. Another one comes from the rest frame hypothesis. So the one where we have the horizon in the real world or some stable point. We have a lot of experiences, especially when we have a seated experience, that are in the cockpit. You know, you have just a bunch of controls and the whole frame in front of you. Which gives you a point that will always be stable compared to your head movement. Then we have 3D head user display methods that are not directly the same as in FPSs and 2D games, but it's like you have a certain object in the world that will be connected, that is 3D, like an arrow, like a the virtual arrow that is not connected to objects in the real world, but it points you in a certain direction. And it's going to be connected to your head direction.
I was going to say, is that part of your heads-up display, in a sense? Like
in a sense,
an arrow, like a compass rose that is always pointed north in your heads-up display, but it's kind of a 3D compass rose.
Yes.
Okay. So basically a reference point for, that helps you understand the environment and your orientation to that environment.
There are also two other techniques in the rest frame. One is that you create a nose in virtual reality.
That's right.
So in the real life, you really don't pay attention to a nose. So then some scientists came up with the idea that you just make a virtual nose there.
And what's interesting, you're saying you don't pay attention to your nose, but if you, everyone, if you look down right now, look at your nose, you will see that it's there. And that nose is actually always there. The fact that you see it all the time, your brain is very good at deleting that out of there. And if I know this right, correct me if I'm wrong, Christoph, is that they added the nose in this experiment. And I think the majority of the users did not even notice the difference between having a nose and not having a nose. Yes. But the results were that motion sickness was reduced by about 10 to 15%, something about along those lines. So it's not significantly, you know, I mean, it is significant from a statistics standpoint, but at least it's something to guide us to understand that having a reference frame or something attached to your face and bridging the gap between your movement in real life and your movement in the virtual world.
Then there is also another technique currently in development, but the author was sending around the first version for people to test. Aza, do you remember the name of the author of this grid technique? When you see a hexagon grid in front of you, like on the sphere space around you, that just overlays the real environment anytime that you start moving.
I remember seeing this on Reddit a couple of months ago, I believe. And I actually saw it implemented in an experience. I'm sorry, I've done so many VR experiences, I don't even remember which one was what, but basically you can look whenever you are walking around, you put not too thick bordered, kind of a thin bordered hexagon around the, like completely encompassing your heads up, you know, your vision. And it feels like the screen of your heads up display just has like borders around it, and you can walk around, and then when you stop, they go away.
Yes.
And so those are just like very, very strong reference points for you to hold on to as you're moving around. And they definitely help with motion sickness.
And from my own experience, I've tested this app a few times and it was making a big difference. I've tested all those moments where I usually got sick and they mostly were gone, or at least appearing much later.
And we'll have these in the show notes and everything. You can definitely try it. What are we calling it? The grid technique?
Yes.
Okay.
When I finally dig out the emails, I will find the proper name that the author used. But for now, let's call it grid technique. Then we have another method that is, instead of you moving in virtual world, you are grabbing the world and moving the world around you.
Right. Can you say more about that?
So the example would be Meltdown. You can buy this on the Steam, and it's a game where you have isometric camera, and then you look down, and then the camera is attached to the character. But when you move the character, actually the map moves under him, so to say. So he's running around the environment, but the camera is looking from above.
If you think about this, actually, if you have a leap motion, they do have a predefined gesture of opening your hand, closing it, and then grabbing something and moving it. And I've seen some experiences. There was a world building experience that just won. It was pretty high up in the 3D game jam awards for Leap Motion, that you pretty much do that fist gesture. Mm-hmm. You grab the world and you can pull it and push it around you. So you mm-hmm. yourself are stationary and everything around you moves. But it doesn't rotate. I think if you maybe it does rotate, but I feel like if you do more rotation kind of things, it might be a bit more motion sickness inducing.
There is another method experience that sort of fits in this world as an object idea. It's called Rose. Mm-hmm. It's about a small prince. It's on Gear VR. And there you look at the planet on which the small prince was living. And you press the touchpad when you look at it, and then by touching touchpad, you grab the planet. And when you rotate, the position of the planet changes, but not the rotation. So if you rotate by 90 degrees, then you will see the right side of the planet.
Oh, interesting. So I'm having trouble visualizing it, but I can see how that would work.
It's one of those VR experiences, but you just need to test it. It's just no other way to explain it.
Yeah, like anything else, really.
Then in many experiences, we have a fly through. You know, if you know the one about the blood system, I think it's called Body VR or something like that. It's also for Kill VR. There you mm-hmm. just fly through the blood system of a human. To make it better and deal with the fact that you are moving in virtual world, but not in the real world, you add waypoints. By waypoints, I mean that you have some objects to which you can like relate, that there was a house, there was something else, or that you have a line on which you fly.
Right.
And additionally, the effect would be that you see those landmarks and then you can predict where you're going to move. That's mm-hmm. the most important thing here, because the problem with the motion sickness is that it's better if you can predict the movement. So if you have a car, if you're driving a car, some people have a motion sickness when they drive as a passenger, but the moment that they are a driver, they don't feel motion sickness anymore. That's because they can predict how the car is going to behave, because that's going to be caused by them. So the waypoints also provide us this way to predict what's going to happen.
Yeah, no, I can agree. So next.
Then another one would be delay compensation.
And how do you define this as? So basically, helping prediction be a big part of motion sickness is that they really need to help the user understand what's going to be happening. Like, can they predict if they move in this way, this is what's going to happen? Am I getting that right?
Okay, so the last and most exciting method to decrease motion sickness are motion platforms. So the omnidirectional treadmills and alike. Just like Omni treadmill or CyberRift. And this is solving the biggest problem. So the biggest problem is that if you don't move in a real life, you may have motion sickness due to vestibular system having a wrong information. But what if you could actually walk in the real life? Like unlimited distance, not just like with HTC Vive where you have to teleport at some point because you reach the maximum range of tracking. But you can actually walk all you want. And this is solving the biggest problem of motion sickness.
Right, because you're actually getting the person to move as close to real life as you can. Yes.
However, it's not risk-free because they are simplified version of walking, because you need to somehow move in place, which may cause an incongruency between your real-life motion or how you expect to move and how this platform is allowing you to move.
Right. Maybe with experience that you can actually get better at, you know, letting your brain take over or letting the movements take over. And there's some other passive motion platforms.
Yeah, just like the Birdly from Somniacs.
Birdly.
It was Yes, go on.
Well, let's explain what they do. You know, so Birdly is basically you would lie down on this table-looking thing, and there are these other platforms underneath your arms and legs, and you would just like literally flap your arms as you're lying down horizontally. And it's and I think they also have a fan in front of your head, and it's just pushing air past you. So you're doing the same motions as a bird, and their experience is that you're flying as a bird. So the act of control of flying with your arms helps reduce motion sickness because you're actually doing it. So basically, try to get as close to the real motion as you can for whatever is happening. And you know, if you reduce the discrepancy, then you reduce the motion sickness together.
And the last method we would like to talk about is that if you are using any motion tracking, then it's good if you inform user when he is about to cross the border, just like HTC 5 is doing. If you reach the maximum range of the tracking, then they are showing you this fence that in the moment you will lose tracking. Which is a good thing, because if you have, for example, especially head tracking camera, and then you're about to leave the range, then if you leave it, you will have this jerking effect where your head is just going, where your picture is just going crazy and totally chaotic.
And I mean, the Vive does this obviously with the chaperone system, and it's probably the one their best selling point right now in terms of how they have overdockless, other than their controllers. But with the DK2, it's probably the most jarring experience when you walk out of the positional tracking area and suddenly you lose positional tracking and it acts like a DK1 and it's just like, oh, what is happening? So having warning guides and just like place-based guides definitely helps so much with having a smooth user experience. So, you know, hopefully the Oculus will have something like that as well.
Yes.
So
I think it's enough for now. For the first heavy content podcast, I'd say that was already a lot.
Yeah. So just quickly to summarize, I mean, we don't have to go in depth again, but hardware, make sure the hardware is consistent, I mean, is working well and you have, you know, good refresh rates. Keep your FPS refresh rate locked in at least 60 hertz per, you know, at 60 hertz and 60 frames per second, optimally at 90. Don't ever take away actual motion control from the user. You know, don't put them on a roller coaster. Visual acceleration. So basically, don't try to do head bobbing and keep the eyes kind of at the same place. And if they're moving forward, don't use acceleration. Kind of do a smooth motion of forward. Never go lateral, sideways, side to side. That's another pretty big one, unless they're actually standing up and they can do it themselves, like a Vive or whatnot. And another thing is experience. You know, make sure if sometimes motion sickness things can be taken over, can be solved by just having more experience, but that's obviously never a good excuse to tell someone if they're feeling sick that they don't have enough experience. Another major big one is having reference points and rest frames for you to kind of cling onto, for your eyes to see that part is moving with you whenever you're moving around in the environment. And that can come as a form of heads-up display, that can come as a form of kind of a 3D compass rose that we talked about, or even this really interesting hexagonal shape that takes over the borders that kind of come around your screen.
However, be careful with the heads-up display, because you can't do it exactly the same as in the 2D games.
No, yes. They need to be actually, with half, like quite a distance away from you. So if you're doing a helmet, it needs to be kind of bigger. Look at Adrift, actually. Adrift does it pretty well, pretty interesting with how they do heads-up display.
So I hope everyone got something good and informative out of this podcast. Like we said, we're testing out kind of a new and more structured podcast. And so we're really digging down into every research paper we can find about a certain topic and bringing it to you in a kind of a fun and discussion based way, so that it's not as dry as it would be reading on paper. But if you do still want to read on paper, because like we know, learning really happens when you hear about it and also see it, we are going to be putting everything that we talked about on the show notes and as chapters and on our website. So you know, if you want to go back and reread something, look more into it, you know, don't hesitate to do that. Leave us comments, likes, you know, comments, concerns. You know, you can tweet at us. So actually, if you have any suggestions as to different topics that you want us to explore that you don't really know much about, you know, please contact us.
And don't forget to spread out into the world that we exist.
Yeah, if you know any other people that would be interested in gaining something from having a research-based VR podcast, then
you can also suggest to us topics that are most important to you right now,
or guests.
Yeah,
or guests. Yes, or guests. We have a certain plan for a number of shows and topics that we want to do. But if you have something pressing, please contact us.
That's right. All right, everybody. Thanks, everyone. This was a little bit longer than usual, but very informative nevertheless. Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Chris, for joining us back.
Thank you, Azad.
And we'll see everybody next time.
Goodbye. Hear you later.
Bye-bye.